It tells a fractured galaxy that the New Republic is capable of delivering its own brand of law and order. And it helps us understand how all of this happened. Once we know that, we can work together to ensure that history does not repeat itself.
Thank you. But I don't understand what this has to do with General, Captain Solo.
Leia pauses. Her face is like a wave about to break. There in her eyes is a war for control. As if she knows it is her job to be calm and measured. But what she really wants is to let it all loose. All the pent-up feelings, all the frustrations of running a government, all her fears and desires. She says the words slowly, carefully.
Han went missing. I need him found. And your team finds people.
You want us to find him?
You don't need to go out of your way.
Leia seems suddenly rattled.
To speak frankly, none of this is precisely above board. And you can, in turn, tell me no. This isn't me commanding you. This is me asking for your help.
She proceeds to explain what she knows.
Han and Chewbacca, his co-pilot, went on some half-cocked mission to free the Wookiee planet of Kashyyyk. But it was a ploy by the Empire. They captured Chewie, and Han barely escaped. Now he's out there alone, and his last transmission ended abruptly. And I haven't heard from him since. I fear he's in danger.
Leia pauses. Her face tightens with sorrow. But again, she pauses, takes a deep breath, and seems to swallow her grief. Nora says,
I didn't realize you two were married.
It was right there on the Endor moon, after everything. We had a small ceremony, just those we trust. We don't keep it secret, but we didn't make it public either.
It must be hard, then, having him gone.
It is. You know something about that, don't you?
She means Brenton. Even just thinking about him brings the memory to bear, like the bloom of heat from a crashing ship. Stormtroopers kicking down their door. The Imperial officer with a writ of arrest.
Then dragging her husband out into the night. Her comforting Temen into mourning, assuring the boy that they'd bring Brenton back in the morning. That it was all just a mistake. That everything would be fine.
That was years ago. They haven't seen Brenton since. Nora has grown woefully comfortable with the idea that her husband and Temen's father is most likely dead.
I understand. Yes.
Nora says, forcing a small smile.
Do you have any information on where Captain Solo is?
He was searching the Outer Rim, and he said he was close to wild space. I can send you a map of the Falcon's movements. He's far enough out there, our sensors can no longer reliably track that hunk of wonderful junk he calls a freighter. I'll forward the map to your quarters. You can send them directly to the ship. Docking plat OB-99.
Nora pauses, then adds,
We'll find him.
It's a promise she feels ill-equipped to make. And as soon as she makes it, the burden of the task at hand puts a tremendous weight on her. A crushing weight, in fact. But what can she say? What can she do? It's out there now. Her promise is a living thing. Leia smiles.
Warmly, truly warmly, as all the ice has melted, and nods. I believe you. Thank you, Nora Wexley. May the Force be your guide.
Chapter 6. It is not easy to sneak away from your own command. It took a bit of doing, in fact. She considered faking an illness, but these days, with all eyes on her as the identified leader of the Galactic Empire, the barest sniffle will have her swarming in nurse droids and health technicians. Instead, Rae Sloane's ruse went like this. She used her already overburdened schedule as an advantage. She told Ferrik Abdur, that she had to take time to talk about fleet movements with Vice Admiral Galen, which was true enough. Galen's been asking for a meeting to discuss just that for days, no, weeks now. She sent word ahead to Galen's office that she couldn't meet today because she had a meeting with General DeVore's to discuss troop movements. That would incite the ire of Galen, but the man would take it in stride. He would swallow his impatience and toe the line as he always had. To DeVore's, she sent word that she wanted a meeting, but had to take time out to meet with Ferrick Abdur in propaganda. And so the triangle of deception was arranged. 3 points, one leading to the other. Unless someone was truly diligent about checking her whereabouts, it would seem from each to each that she had to move one meeting in favor of another. Few would seek to disturb her, lest they incite her ire. And Sloane was known for not taking that in stride. She did not toe any line. These days, she was the line, and none dared cross her. None except their mysterious fleet admiral, of course. The next step of her ruse required Adia's help. Sloane couldn't just hop into a craft and take off for regions unknown. She ran a tight ship. Accountability was king. A single ship gone missing was a breach of bureaucratic structure. And bureaucracy, vile as many considered it, was the foundation on which the entire galaxy was built. Bureaucracy would save them all. Violating that bureaucracy would upset the checks and balances. Unless, of course, Sloane had Adia change the designation and destination of a small supply ship. And so, an Imperial Lambda-class shuttle scheduled for Questel got rerouted instead to bring a load of Namite batteries and transponder arrays to the throne world of Coruscant. The pilot, a young recruit named Dasha Bowen, or so the registry says. Really, it's just a watertight identity also put together by Adia.
Imperial Shuttle CS-831, Sloane says into the comm. This is transport pilot Dasha Bowen, transmitting clearance code and credentials now.
Ahead, Coruscant glows brightly. A massive world, carved with lines of light. The geometric patterns of its planet-encompassing Ecumenopolis, giving it the look of being on the edge of breaking apart. As if a frozen moment in time captures it seconds before it glows, swells, and detonates.
That may be truer than I care to admit, she thinks.
The throne world of the Empire is in the midst of being pulled apart. Not so dramatically as having its mantle shattered, no, but its populace is undergoing that kind of tectonic shift. The citizens in some sectors have risen up against the Empire, while others have instead fought against their insurgent neighbors. A veritable civil war. One whose flames are stoked nicely by the New Republic resistance fighters entrenched on the surface. They sow distrust. Chaos is the result. All around her little cargo ship, a defensive armada forms a protective shield around the planet. These are ISB ships, Imperial Security Bureau, not the Navy. Admiral Rax was very clear on that point. He said that they were not to commit resources protecting the throne world. The ISB is controlling this world, and the Navy doesn't want any part of it. It shows the fractures in the Empire. All the broken pieces drifting apart.
It is a symbol, he told her, of our indolence and torpidity. It is the mouldering core of our overripe fruit, and I wish to cut away such rot so as to preserve our sweet remains, and, of course, the seeds within.
She argued that saving Coruscant would be a better symbol. He answered with,
It is a far greater consequence to show how much we are willing to lose to preserve the strength of our empire.
It was then that he echoed the words of Count Vidian.
Forget the old way.
Was this echo deliberate? How would he know what Vidian told her?
We must discard the obvious choices, Admiral Sloane. We must forge our own path through the stars, if we are to survive. And with that, the argument was done. Now she hovers above the world, a world they have willfully forgotten. One left to the ISB, under the command of Palpatine's old administrator, Grand Vizier Masamida. She wonders idly what it would take to retake the planet. The New Republic could fairly easily wipe out the ISB's defensive blockade. It would take time, but reports arrive daily of the Republic's growing military might. Still, the Empire's presence here on the surface is deeply dug in. An aerial campaign wouldn't be enough. Finally, her comm crackles, and a response returns.
Code checks out. Cleared for landing, CS-831.
Of course it does, she thinks.
Adia knows what she's doing. Dasha Bowen sets the ship for a landing trajectory. Sloane leaves the cargo ship behind on the landing platform. Droids move to unload the very real technical parts from inside its hold. While they are occupied, she pulls her visor low. The visor both hides her face and, with the tap of a button on the side of the helmet, pulls up a heads-up display, glowing on the plastoglass shield. In this case, it's a map of Coruscant. Her destination is a pulsing red star on the map, the old Hall of Imperial Register building, less affectionately known as the Pit. It is a storehouse of deeds, records, and data dumps. It is to most a worthless aggregation of the Empire's bureaucracy. As records pile up in ships and transports and nav computers across offices and academies and depots, those records must occasionally be offloaded to backup. And so they are dumped here, off-site, often by a droid. Few care to come here, for combing through the information is an act not unlike trying to find one particular grain of sand on a windswept beach. Worse, the information is often quite valueless. Trajectory calculations, inventory lists, personnel records all fill the massive warehouse of data. But it's that last bit she's looking for. Personnel records. If there's anything about Gallius Rax, it will be here. That is, if she can find it. Thankfully, Sloane is quite adept at navigating this place. To others, it is a pit. To her, it is a temple. The pit sits at the margins of the Verity District, a well-fortified imperial part of Coruscant, home to the Hall of Adjudication, the Institute to Preserve Imperial History, and the ISB Academy and offices. The streets here are usually clean, well-kept, and busy. But now, not so much. She passes a pair of stormtroopers sitting against a steel barricade, helmets off their heads and held between their legs. The two men are sweaty, tired, and staring off at nothing. Ahead, the street is scarred with starburst streaks of char. The plasticrete shattered and cracked as if by thermal detonator. It's quiet, too. Usually she'd hear the thrumming, vibrant traffic of the city above her. Speeders and grav bikes whipping past in crisscrossing lines like little myrmidons serving their colony. Now, though, the sky above is dead. Not a single speeder. No droids, no birds, nothing. The airspace is closed, isn't it? She'd heard reports of citizens loading up their speeders with explosives and driving them into Imperial buildings. Then, as if on cue, the ground shudders. Somewhere off in the distance, just such an explosion. She can feel it vibrate up through her heels, all the way into her teeth. Sloane can't see anything, but it isn't long before she sees the trail of red smoke climbing into the sky like a crawling serpent. Klaxons go off. A pair of ISB speeders streak overhead. What a horror show, she thinks. But Rey has no time to dwell on this. Her time here is limited, and she has to move. The pit is ahead. From the surface, it looks like nothing but a single-story fortified bunker. It has a single door and a shuttered window. As Sloane approaches, the shutter slides up with a rattle-bang. There stands the top half of an administrative droid, its capsule-shaped head leaning forward. From its mouthpiece comes a tinny, mechanized voice.
Hold still for ocular scan!
Sloane can't hide from this. No matter how well-crafted the persona of Dasha Bowen, Adia's efforts do not carry as far as creating a whole new pair of eyeballs. This one will not be faked, and so she lifts her visor. From the droid's own eye comes a shimmering red beam. She blinks and winces as it passes over her face.
Grand Admiral Ray Sloane, it is good to see you. Welcome to the Hall of Imperial Register. Please watch your step. The fall is quite steep.
The droid is right. The pit is 50 floors. Not straight up, but rather straight down. Plunged into the exomantle of Coruscant like a pneumatic bolt. The shape of it is circular, and it spirals ineluctably downward, giving Sloane the sense that she is swirling down the drain. At the bottom, she half expects that the Hall of Imperial Register gobbles you right up like a mouth, a sarlacc nesting at the nadir, digesting wayward data miners. She will not be digested. Not today. She will, however, go mad if she doesn't get moving. Inertia is a curse, and Sloane's whole life and career have been about combating it. So she sets up shop in a little alcove. Hours pass. The droid attendants, more administrative droids, these fixed to the railings so that they can zip past the shelves of records, both hard copy and digital, bring her old data cartridges. She told them that she needed a proper accounting of all the ships of the Imperial Navy in play as of the destruction of the second Death Star. She's on her eighth and final cartridge. She starts with the Dreadnoughts, the Superstar Destroyers. 13 were in service before the revivified Death Star was destroyed above Endor. One of those is the Ravager, the SSD from which Sloane rules the Empire, and which, strictly speaking, is now Galen's command. One of those is the Executor, Vader's command ship. The Executor was lost that day, plunging into the surface of the Death Star, taking hundreds of thousands of the best Imperials with it. Sloane shudders as she thinks of it. That leaves 11 others. 3 are now in the hands of the New Republic. 2 of those were from admirals willingly surrendering the ship and its people. 1 was taken forcibly by New Republic forces while it underwent repairs over Kuat. 5 were destroyed outright in battles across the galaxy with the New Republic. The ships were understaffed, underprotected, and on the run. The Dreadnoughts are home to massive batteries of fleet-killing weapons, yes, but are also slow, unwieldy beasts. They hang there in the sky like bricks. And without adequate protection, it is an inevitability that enemy forces could erode the ships until obliteration ensues. 1 was taken by pirates. The Annihilator. Tag's old ship. But who controls the Annihilator now? The reports don't say. Another, the Arbitrator, made a bad hyperspace calculation to escape pursuing NR ships. It evaporated when it was sucked into a gravity well. That leaves Palpatine's own command ship, the Eclipse. Records show that it, too, was destroyed by a fleet of New Republic vessels. Ackbar's own frigate, Home One, firing the ship-killing shot. Ah, but there's the catch. And it's why Sloane is here. The ships dumped data across the stars, transmitting pulses of information to this location. That provides a black box recording of information so one could discern what exactly happened before a ship was destroyed, captured, or surrendered. All the other tracking data adds up to the known fates of each SSD. Their stories match the data for all of them, except one. For the Eclipse, the data ends a full day cycle before the ship was reportedly destroyed. It shows no siege by New Republic forces. It simply drops off the star map. gone. Vanished. Sloan concedes that it's possible the ship stopped reporting due to a malfunction in its data recorder, though redundant systems were supposed to alert command if that had happened. Again, bureaucracy and reiterative mechanisms should have saved the day here. And yet they didn't. Is it possible that the Eclipse is still out there? Could the Ravager not be the last Super Star Destroyer in the naval arsenal? The inventory of the Star Destroyers is similar, but on a far grander scale. 75% of the Star Destroyers in service before Endor can capably be tracked to similar fates. Destroyed, captured, lost in confirmable if curious ways. But a full quarter of those ships cannot be accounted for. Records show fateful ends that contradict their black box recordings. Does the Empire have more ships than she knows? Ghost fleets out there somewhere? Are they operating independently? Have they been captured or abandoned? Something else may be going on. Does Rax know? Or is he in the dark too? Speaking of Gallius Rax, picking through the data to find anything on the erstwhile fleet admiral will be an act of finding a precious gem in a box of broken glass. It will be a slow and miserable retrieval. But it's why she's really here. So she summons a droid and sets it to work.
I will see what data I can excavate,
the droid says, then gives a small nod before its servo motors whir and carry it away.
Excavate,
she thinks. A perfect word, and from a droid no less. Flip, flip, flip. Page after page on the cartridge reader. She palms the control orb and swipes it left again and again, scrolling through endless administrative pages. Here, as with the naval archives, the presence of Rax is naught but a vapor trail. She's chasing shadows. And so she's down to searching the records of those who associated with him. Ilarin, Rancid, Screed, and Palpatine himself. She cross-references personnel reports, genealogical records, inventory lists, anything, everything. Hours pass. Her eyes are bleary. She feels alone and overwhelmed, and the only sound that accompanies her frustration and her anxiety is the sound of droids clicking and clacking and rattling about. She stands up. The search is over. Rax barely exists. Trying to figure out who he is or who he was is an act of grabbing at fog. It dissipates in your hand while still obscuring everything beyond it. It's time to go. So she packs up her notes and tucks them in a side satchel before slinging it over her shoulder. Suddenly, movement behind her. She wheels on it, reaching for her blaster. It's the droid. Of course it is. It wouldn't be anyone else. And yet, well, she has to excuse her own shock.
I'm tired and angry.
The droid buzzes.
An image crystal.
It extends a telescoping arm. In it, a small smoke-gray crystal. The Empire doesn't use these anymore, as they're somewhat antiquated. But decades before, single-serving image crystals were still in use. Now the Empire has the ability to archive visual and textual information across cartridges or data cards. She's about to hand it back. What could one image matter? Still, the reader is right here. She unslings the bag and, without sitting, places the crystal in the smooth portal on the alcove desk, then hits the button beneath it so it lights up. A three-dimensional image emerges in the space before her. It looks like somewhere in an Imperial docking bay. In the background, a Lambda-class shuttle sits. At the margins of the hollow, white-armored stormtroopers and a pair of red-armored Imperial Royal Guardsmen. There, in the middle of the photo, Wolf Ularin, Dodd Rancid, Terranald Screed, plus three others. Grand Vizier Mos Amida, Emperor Palpatine, and a boy. Or rather, a boy on the cusp of being a young man. The boy looks like a dirt-cheeked rube, shoved into an ill-fitting academy uniform. His hair is dark, his skin is pale. Those eyes, though, a familiar arrogance shines there, each a black hole swallowing the light. One thing stands out. One of the boy's hands is facing outward, and Sloan sees something across his palm. A marking of some kind. A tattoo? Or a brand? This holographic image by itself does nothing to illuminate who Rax is. And yet it stirs in her a strange kind of hope. In this act of excavation, she has found a rather curious fossil, hasn't she? If this is him, if this is Gallius Rax, then the mystery of his presence becomes one she can solve. He becomes a beast she can kill. Not literally, of course. Or so she hopes. What next, then, for this mystery? She has a bit of thread in her hands. How shall she pull it? Four of the men in the image glowing before her are dead. Palpatine is gone. Yularen died on the Death Star. Rancid perished in a rebel attack. Though she's heard rumors that Vader executed him for treason. And Screed was killed by pirates off the Iktari Circle. Which leaves one left alive. It is time, she thinks, to pay Mos Amida a visit.
Interlude. Coronet City. Corellia.
Erno watches the kid do it. The little dum-dum doesn't even know he's being watched. Kid creeps up to the wall like a scuttling spider under the cover of night, then takes the stencil to the pale brick and pulls out the light painter. He shakes it a few times and gives it a hit, and then it pulses an image onto the side of the PNS station. Peace and security. An iconic image of a bad, bad man. Maybe not even a man. Maybe a machine. Vader lives, it says. That's stenciled underneath the all-too-familiar artist rendering of the helmeted thug. The kid turns, grinning like he got away with it. He didn't. Erno steps into the halo of light from the street orb overhead, and he clears his throat so the kid in the dark hood and cloak looks up. Another one of these acolyte idiots. Erno whistles.
Nice art. Real original.
The kid doesn't say anything. He stands there quaking in his bare feet. He's young, dumb, scared. Erno sighs and levels his blaster.
Come on, you little roach rat. Turn around, turn around. Let's get these binders on.
Pouting, the boy turns and Erno slaps on a pair of binders, then hauls him around front and in through the doors of the station. The new hire at the front desk, a pretty Pantoran named Kaisa, says,
Hey, detective.
And he gives her a wink and a nod, even though she'd probably never have anything to do with a scruffy, thick neck like him. Erno drags the kid through the station and past the desks and the holoscreens and the peace officers and into one of the back rooms. He gives the kid a light shove, and the boy lands hard in a chair. The boy hisses something at him. It isn't in a language he understands, and he doesn't care to ask about it.
Uh-huh, sure, whatever, kid.
Erno sits down across from the boy and pops a cut square of rubber root in his mouth, giving it a good chew. It tastes like the underside of a boot, but gives his mouth something to do, and better this than the stim sticks he used to smoke. He gets the boy's measure fast. Human punk. Maybe 14, maybe 15. Pale like the others. They pretend they're nocturnal. Black hood, black cloak. This one doesn't have a mask, though. A lot of these acolyte freaks, they put together these masks, hammering together plastoid, metal, wood, goggles, ventilators, whatever, and wear them as they harangue the locals. It's all pathetic, paltry stuff.
Vandalism, mostly.
Vader lives, Erno says, chawing on the rubber root. Vader lives, you say? Last I heard, he went up with the Death Star. Boom. He's dead. If he was ever even alive. Empire's falling apart. And it wouldn't be if he was still around, don't you think?
Death isn't the end.
Last I checked, it's pretty much the final stop, kid.
The boy grins. His teeth are white. Too white. His tongue snakes along them. And for a moment, Erno feels his guts clench. His instincts are telling him something's wrong here, but he doesn't know what.
No, this kid's just getting to you. It's late. You've been on duty for too long now. Get this moron booked and head home. What's your name?
Oblivion.
He snorts with derisive laughter.
Oh, that's a nice name. That a family name?
The loser doesn't say anything. He just sits there, chest rising and falling like a cornered feral animal.
Look, kid, I got you for vandalism. You can spend a couple nights down in the hole. But I'm feeling friendly. I'm feeling generous. You roll over on a couple of your acolyte buddies. You are an acolyte of the beyond, right? And I'll get you out of here with a stern finger wagging and not much else, hmm?
Still, the boy says nothing. Erno sighs.
What's the deal with you pouty little thugs anyway? You what, a bunch of suck-ups for the Empire?
Not the Empire. Something greater than the Empire.
Vader?
The boy grins.
Not Palpatine.
Again, the boy says nothing. That grin only widens. Makes sense, Erno figures. Who would think that old withered twig was worth a measure of twisted hero worship? Vader at least looked like a tough guy. Imposing, dangerous, a real bad bag of tricks.
You don't have a mask?
Erno asks.
I don't.
Why not? The mask is more the Vader thing, huh? Trying to look like him? You know he was a bad guy, right?
Are you a decent man?
The boy asks.
A good guy?
Hardly,
Erno thinks. His wife has left him for a pair of artists in the Tino Village District. His neighbors think he's a slob. Even the fish in his fish tank give him a dubious look every morning when he leaves for work.
I asked about your mask.
The boy shifts in his seat.
You have to earn your mask.
Oh! You haven't earned it yet?
The kid looks up at the ceiling, then around the room at the bare walls.
This building is very old.
Yeah, so?
I know what's downstairs.
What's downstairs? The museum next door uses the shared basement with the P&S building. The detectives keep evidence locked up down there. And the museum uses the same lockup to keep a bunch of old, musty, dusty artifacts and the like. Erno's about to pick this apart, because really, why does this snot-dribbling punk care? Maybe it's a clue. Maybe the kid's parents work for the museum. Could be a... But then, someone comes in the room. It's a security officer. Spob Rydell, hat in hand.
Erno, you ought to see this! I'm busy, Rydell,
he thinks. But fine, fine. If one of the security ops guys wants him to see something, so be it. He takes the kid's wrists and brings them to the tabletop before slapping a button underneath the surface. The table goes magnetic, and the kid's binder cuffs thud hard to the tabletop as the magnetic field pulls them down. Then he's up and back through the station, and the holoscreens are turning to CCI, the Coronet City Info Channel, one by one. It takes Erno a second to gauge what he's even seeing. Holo feeds from various areas around the city all show similar scenes. Downtown in Diadem Square,
A horde of hooded and cloaked figures are mobbing storefronts and leaping on top of the air tucks to pull the speeders down to the ground. On the one line of the maglevel subway, they swarm aboard as soon as the train stops at the Juni Street station. Down by the casinos, they rush those coming out and going in, dark cloaks fluttering in the night. They carry sticks, sticks painted red. They have masks. Some kind of concerted attack. A riot. Or worse. Already the officers here are mobilizing, streaming out the door, or heading up the stairs to the speeder pad on the roof.
It's the Griffin Acolytes,
Rydell says.
Ain't you got one in the back room there? Bring his narrow can out here. Let's kick it around a little.
Yeah, yeah, Erno thinks. He stomps to the back room he was in, throws the doors wide, and the kid is gone. Just then, the lights flicker once, then twice, then go out. Erno is in darkness. Thankfully, a few seconds later, the emergency lights come up. They line the floor and the ceiling, casting everything in a red glow. He curses under his breath and heads back out into the main room, and already most of the building is cleared out. It's him, Rydell, a couple of other detectives like Shreen and Mersey, and... wait, wasn't Kaiser here? Where the hell'd she go? He's about to say something to Rydell, but then a blaster shot threads the air, clipping the officer square in the forehead. Rydell falls backward. Two more blasts, and Shreen and Mersey fall. Shreen flips backward over her desk, and Mersey just slumps forward against a hydro cooler. Erno fumbles at his back for his own blaster, but he's too slow. There's Kaiza. Kaiza, of all the people. She has a standard sec-issued blaster pointed up and at him. The kid in black is nowhere to be seen.
Kaiza, I don't get what's happening here, doll.
I'm not your doll.
Her voice trembles as she speaks.
What is this?
She slowly crosses the space between them, winding her way through the sea of desks, through the red-lit half-dark.
This is a revolution. This is the revenge of the darkness. This is oblivion.
Fucking hell, Erno says. You're one of them?
He figures she's not trained. She's scared. He can hear that much in her voice. So he goes for his blaster anyway. He's old, but she's not a cop. His hand finds his blaster, and his arm extends. The air lights up next to him. The world thrums as a red beam of light whisks upward through all his face. A searing line of pain across his wrist. And then, the hand that held the blaster is gone. It thumps against one of the desks, still clutching the blaster. He watches it fall and tumble away. It's an absurd thing to see your own hand coming off like that. Next to him is the kid in the cloak. He has a red-bladed lightsaber in his hand.
I told you I knew what was in the basement, he sees.
That's the blade we've been looking for?
Kaiza asks him. The acolyte gives an over-eager nod. Then... Kaiza clubs Erno in the side of the head. The world spins away from him as he tumbles to the floor. She bends down and whispers in his ear.
Beta lives, and so do you. Tell everyone the acolytes are coming, doll.
Chapter 7. The bar is a little seaside joint off Janari Point, a few clicks outside Hana City proper. It's not much to look at. A round bar of dark wood under a wind-ruffled tent. Bula birds strut about the pebbles and sand, their star-tipped beaks overturning rocks to look for their next meal to come skittering out. The ocean slides in and out, with less of the crash and clamor of proper waves, and more the hiss and whisper of a calm lake lapping at its shore. The night is cool. The spitting rain is done, leaving behind a breeze. Singier sits, staring into a white mug of black liquid, steam rising around him, warming his chin. Tonight, the bar has a few other patrons, other Chandrillans over there, an angler with a firm chin staring down at her pint of fizzing something or other. On the other side, a young man in a fancy, breezy shirt, glaring at his holoscreen with grave disinterest. The bartender, a tall woman with her white blonde hair pulled back in a complex braid that loops around her neck like a collar, eases past, asking,
"Everything good?"
He gives a small nod. As she passes, he sees her gaze turn up. She spies someone coming, someone behind Singier. He's about to tense up, and then, half a second later, an arm slides around his neck on the right side and on his left. A scruffy and familiar head appears on his shoulder, sandy beard scratching his collarbone.
"Well, hello,"
Singier says, arching an eyebrow. The man's free hand snakes over Singier's right shoulder and grabs the mug, then pulls it to his head so he can sniff it.
"This is Cav,"
the man says with a frown.
"What?"
Singier says, feigning shock.
"Cav? Well, I didn't order this. I must burn this place down in protest. It is the only recourse."
The man, Condor Kyle, rolls his eyes.
"You're very dramatic. I'm just surprised you're drinking this and not, say, Kowakian rum. Or, I don't know, hull stripper. I'm trying to stay awake to see you. Hence the calf."
He holds up the mug and leers over its lip.
"Oh, and I'll have you know that Hull Stripper was my nickname at the Imperial Officers Academy."
"I don't doubt that."
Condor leans in to kiss Sinju's cheek. Alarm bells go off inside his head. Reflexively, he pulls his face to the side. He scoots his stool a few centimeters away from the man.
"That can't be good,"
Condor says.
"You done with me so soon?"
"Now who's being dramatic?"
"So what is it, then?"
"I told you. I don't like this."
"This?"
"This! This, the public thing."
Condor hip-bumps a stool closer to Singier, then plops down on it. His elbow plants on the bar, and he leans against his hand, his face twisting into a dubious, bemused mask.
"You do know where you are, right? You're safe here, Rathvelis. We're safe here. Chandrilla is pretty open."
Condor exists on that perfect line between pretty and manly. He's got a barrel chest and big arms, a laser-shorn scalp, and that patchy, spiky beard of his. But he's also got long, theatrical lashes and pouty lips, and skin as smooth and tan as a statue carved of Nemarian Corabaster. Even his voice. It's gravelly, but it has a lilt to it, too. It is rough, but beautiful music. He's also one of the best slicers the New Republic has on deck. Not many systems Kyle can't cut to ribbons if he sets his mind to it. That's how he and Singier met. 2 jobs back, hunting Moff Gorgon. The crew needed someone to break into an interrogator droid's head, and Temin wasn't up to the task. They brought in Condor Kyle. Condor, whom Singier just publicly rebuked.
"It's not that," Singier says. "Not exactly. The Empire..."
"Well, he's explained this all before, hasn't he? Condor knows the deal. The Empire cared little about any sexual or romantic entanglements, provided they didn't have to see it. No matter what your peccadilloes, the Manual of Decorum made it clear that you kept all of that behind closed doors, especially if it violated any of the Empire's family initiatives. They wanted breeders above all else. Worse, Singier knew all too well that affection was a weakness. Relationships were a rope to tie around your throat, a rope all too easy to tug and choke. first thing he did when investigating one of his own for disloyalty was find out whom they were betting. It was always a vital weak spot, as vital and as weak as stabbing a thumb into a person's windpipe or pumping a fist into his kidneys. Knowing who loved whom was a path to exploitation and control.
Affection exposes us. I don't want us exposed. And look, people are staring.
The angler continues to stare down into her drink. The young man in his fancy shirt keeps gazing at his data pad. The bartender stands off to the side, polishing glasses.
Oh, yeah, Condor says.
I feel completely dissected.
Well, what do you know?
Sindhir sips his calf loudly. From behind them, footsteps against the pebbles. Bula birds chatter and hop as two other customers step up to the bar. Sindhir has seen them here before. Both are pilots for the New Republic. The first is a long-nosed Chandrillan with a faint scar across his brow. The other, a slump-shouldered woman with pocked cheeks and a permanent scowl screwed to her ugly mug. Mr. Rauskar steps up to the other side of Sindhir, raps his knuckles on the bar, and calls to the bartender.
A bomb, Groit! Now!
Chip!
Miss Scowlface says, slapping the bar. As the bartender fetches their drinks, Rauskar looks over and glowers long and hard at Sindhir.
I don't like your kind, he says.
Sindhir applauds.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much for proving my point. See, Condor, these pilots do not approve of our lifestyle.
Scowlface pokes her head up over Browscar's shoulder, and her eyes narrow. She sticks her chin out.
We don't like Imperials around here.
So disappointing. That's your problem?
Sindhir blusters.
He's not an Imperial,
Condor says, standing up.
He's on our side.
Well,
Sindhir corrects.
Let's not go that far.
He's a criffing imp is what he is.
Browscar leans forward, baring his teeth. Sindhir can smell the spirits on his breath. The man's already lit up like a laser battery.
A black armor corner-turning cur who will cut our throats if we let him. We don't like his kind. We don't care for imp lovers either.
I get it,
Sindhir says, faking a sip from his mug of calf, a mug he fully intends to break over this man's fool head.
I do. For a long time, the Galactic Empire has run roughshod over every system and station, from the warm, gooey center of the core to the coldest fringes of the Outer Rim. But the Empire's breaking apart, and now all us bad guys are showing up at your door with a shrug and a smile, and asking to be forgiven. And we probably don't deserve it. Yet here we are. That presents a problem for you, because now the question is, will you prove that you're truly the champions of the galaxy? Are you the good guys who can forgive? Or are you just as bad as...
Sindhir's head snaps back from the hit. It's got power behind it, but it's as inelegant and imprecise as a stampeding nerf. His brain rattles, but he doesn't taste blood. He licks his lips to be sure. Nope. His hand curls around the mug. The calf is still hot. It'll leave a lovely burn across the man's scalp. But then Condor's hand finds his and steadies it.
We can just go,
the slicer says in his ear. A breathy whisper. Not scared, simply confident. The pilot stands. Browscar's hands are squeezed into fists, and he's ready for the fight. The man is just itching for it. Sindhir echoes that itch. It crawls inside him like wires in his blood, hot and electric. All Sindhir does, though, is nod.
Good night, gents.
Browscar and Scowlface seem taken aback as Sindhir and Condor lock arms and leave. The calf mug's still on the bar, steaming. morning. Same beach, same sea, same bar. Sinjir had gone, but now he's back. He left Condor and a warm bed behind. A proper bookend to the night, he thought at the time. That, before he drank more and passed out right there. The smeary light of sunrise melts across Sinjir's shut eyes. He smacks his lips and peels himself off the bar top. It makes a noticeable sound, like unwrapping a bandage from a sticky wound. His mouth tastes of... what is that?
Ah, yes,
Soraki. A liquor born of fermented salic berry and pickling spices. Sour and sweet, and totally terrible, and also amazing. He blinks sleep from his eyes. His head still feels wobbly. Which is good, because that means the hangover has not yet gotten its claws into him. A little hair of the Geral, then, to keep him going, and... oh... where, oh, where has that pesky bartender gone? That's grumpy making. It's then, though, that he realizes someone is sitting next to him.
Hello, you, he says.
You blind yourself quite effectively,
Jazz Amari says. She's on the stool next to him, picking her teeth with a narrow-bladed knife.
Yes, Soraki.
She makes a face.
Don't judge until you've partaken,
he mumbles.
I have. It tastes like slug bile.
You don't drink. You're not a connoisseur.
But he yawns and stretches.
That's why we make fine friends, though. You're the nonsense get-it-done bounty hunter, and I'm the soggy but lovable agent provocateur. They should do a Holonet show about us now that the Empire's stranglehold over the media has all but fallen away.
You're mad at me, she says.
What? No, he lies.
Was it John? Are you really mad about him?
Are we really doing this right now?
But he can see by the steel in her gaze that the Zabrak is quite serious indeed.
Eh, fine.
No, it's not John.
You do what you like when pantsless.
It's...
he doesn't want to say it. So for a moment he just lets the words dissolve into a kind of throaty growl until he can finally articulate...
it's the plan. Your plan at Slussen Kanker's fortress.
You went ahead and played your little scheme...
you told the boy, but you didn't tell me.
I should have. I concede.
I don't like being in the dark. Not with you. It makes me squirrely. And it's not just that. It's... I didn't know. I had no idea you were pulling a fast one on us all. That sort of thing. I can usually see it long before it drops out of hyperspace. But somehow you kept it from me. The boy did, too. I'm either losing my touch, or...
more you trust us.
I do.
That bothers you.
It does.
Now it's his turn to make a face.
Let me ask you something.
Ask.
Why do you do it?
Do what?
This. The team, the New Republic...
she cleans the tip of her blade with the pad of her thumb and shrugs.
I don't know. Credits? Debts?
I don't quite believe you.
So don't. Why do you do it?
I'm bored.
It's her turn to say it.
Now I don't quite believe you.
Maybe we both have debts that credits alone cannot pay.
She shrugs.
Maybe we do.
He sniffs and winces. This conversation has gotten far too serious, far too dour.
How'd you find me, anyway?
Gondor told me.
And how'd you find him? I didn't know you knew.
She smirks.
I know everything. I'm good at my job.
She twirls her blade and shoves it back into the sheath at her side.
Which reminds me, we have a job. Nora called.
I thought we had a few days of R&R.
This is your idea of R&R?
She asks, gesturing toward the two figures at the other end of the bar. One of those figures is Browscar, who is belly-flopped across the bar top, flung there like a dead fish. Around his head are the broken remnants of a mug and the cooled puddle of liquid that was in it. The other is Scowlface, who lies supine in the sand, a bar towel held firm to her bloody nose. The woman moans.
At least both of them are still breathing,
Jazz says.
I'm not a murderer.
What did they do, anyway?
He sighs.
They were rude.
Come on, Sin. Let's get to work.
Chapter 8 Sloan comes up out of the pit and steps outside, craning her neck and rolling her shoulders to get the tension out of them. How long was she in there, anyway? The precise answer matters little, as the real answer is, way too long. So long that the lack of her presence on board the Ravager will be noticed by someone. What strikes her immediately is, it's dark. That would be sensible on any other world, because it's late, or at least really, really early. But the thing about Coruscant is, it's a world that never sleeps. The power never goes out. The dark comes, and the whole planet lights up. But here, in the Verity District, it's dark, dark. It's also quiet. The skin on her neck prickles. Something's wrong. She has to move. But where? Her plan was to find herself one of the departing subgrav trains. The Black Line would take her right to the Federal District, after all. But if there's no power up here, what about down there? And finding a taxi won't be an option. Far down the block, three figures run between buildings, ducking and darting until they're out of sight. They're not troopers. She doesn't hear the familiar clatter of their boots and armor. We're under attack. The insurgents are here. Right now. The only recourse is to get to her ship. She hasn't been in action for what feels like too long, but the blade of her instinct hasn't gone dull. She feels suddenly hyper-aware, and her mind goes through the cold, dispassionate calculations that are all too familiar. Stay away from open streets. Move between buildings. Keep your head down. Get your blaster out. A grim realization crawls up inside her. This is what life on the throne world is like now, isn't it? Sloan moves fast, across the street, sliding through the alley between a commissary and BRAC, base realignment and closure building. Ducking behind a compacting trash machine as she checks her blaster, then she's back up and moving. She winds around a med station alongside a repair bay, under the black shadow of a communications array. Ahead, far ahead, the air lights up with a pulsing explosion. Lightning crackles in its white-hot center. And then, it's gone. Alarms sound in its wake. Down a nearby street, an ISB transport roars past, heading toward the source of the explosion. Sloan thinks, I hope that wasn't my landing platform. She takes a step forward, her eyes still adjusting to the white streaks pulsing across her vision. A sound behind her. She wheels. Something clips her across the side of the head, and she goes down. A boot presses on her hand, and the chrome blaster slips from her grip. Another boot kicks her weapon away from her. An absurd defeatist part of her thinks, this is fine. The New Republic soldiers can take her in. Let it all be over. She will make a fine catch for some bush pilot or some hick commando. A guaranteed medal. But a fire warms in her belly. Her heart goes supernova. This is my empire, she thinks. She won't leave it to these brutes.
And she damn sure won't let someone like Rax crash everything she's worked for right into the heart of some star. No, not tonight. Not if she can help it. Sloan rolls toward her own pinned arm, causing no small pain, and reaches up with her free hand to grab at whoever is holding her there. Her fingers find the attacker's belt, and she pulls hard, yanking him down to the ground. It's not even a New Republic soldier. She sees a dark dress and a blue and gold rag bundled around the arm. Local resistance? The man, practically a boy, cries out for help. Other shapes move in toward her, but Sloane is up now in a crouch. Her body is coated with the memory of how to fight. Back in the academy, she practiced and competed in NCB, Naval Corps Boxing. She was good. Never won belt, but she always ranked. And Sloane has kept up with it. The first insurgent who comes at her does so with the inelegance of a drunken man groping for a kiss. She sidesteps him and jabs with a fist, catching him right in the eye. He flails and staggers backward as another one, this one in rough armor and a face shield, steps in to fill the void. Sloane kicks out this one's leg, and her enemy drops, so she drops with her enemy, catching the person's arm as they fall. Sloane pivots herself into an armbar and yanks back on the insurgent's wrist, hard enough that the arm dislocates with a grungy crunch. The terrorist yells, and it's a woman's voice crying out in pain. Sloane kicks off the face shield, then scoops it up and flings it at the next person coming in. It catches the incoming terrorist in the face, and they spin and tumble. But Sloane is too slow and outnumbered. Someone tackles her from the side, and her shoulder crashes hard against the plastocrete. The breath blasts from her lungs as she scrambles against the ground. Something presses hard against the side of her head. A blaster. "Don't move," comes a shaky, uncertain voice. That same voice calls out, "We got one! Imperial. Pilot by the look of her." Sloane goes through a new set of calculations. She could fight back. But if they take her, will she play the role of Grand Admiral Ray Sloane? Or will she instead aim to be Dasha Bowen, harmless pilot? The former has value, the latter almost none. What will serve her best? Someone else moves in. A big man, half his face hidden behind a swaddling of blue and gold fabric. He reaches down with a wide paw and flips her so she's staring up. Sloane shows her hands. The woman with the blaster stands and stares, her face sooty, her eyes deeply set. "Get her up. We'll take her in. Garrus will know what to do with her."
"We could just deal with her here,"
the big guy says. Others start to gather in behind them. Men, women, young and old. Half a dozen.
"Deal with her?"
"Yeah, deal with her."
"That's not who we are."
"Maybe it's who we need to be."
Someone else from behind them, a gruff voice.
"We're not soldiers. We're just taking back our home."
The blaster pointed at Sloane's nose wavers. A new figure joins the group. Someone tall, thin, arms extended out, a pair of batons held in hand. Hard to see anything but the cut of his silhouette. The batons twirl in his grip.
"What have we got here?"
he asks.
"Call us a fish,"
the big guy says. But then someone asks,
"Wait, who are you?"
The new arrival moves like a cyclone. He ducks and spins, jabbing each baton into a different insurgent. The batons bang like slug throwers going off, and it's a giveaway. Those are concussive batons, and they are the signature weapon of someone Sloane has come to work with recently. The bounty hunter. Mercurial Swift. The woman pulls her blaster out of Sloane's face to concentrate on the new attacker. And it's a mistake. Sloane gets up behind her and locks her arm tight around the woman's throat. Tighter, tighter, until the woman slides to the ground. Swift, meanwhile, is up and down like a puppet on yanking strings. The batons jamming under chins and against ribs. Each time this happens, the baton cracks like localized thunder,
and another enemy drops, until the only two left standing are Sloane and Swift.
You,
Sloane sees.
You followed me.
Do we have the time to discuss this right now?
The bounty hunter twirls his batons and clips them back on his utility belt.
I don't think we do. We need to go, Admiral. Unless you want to run into more of your friends.
She does not.
You can get me out of here?
She asks. Swift grins and licks his teeth.
It would be my pleasure.
The speeder skims the tops of the buildings along the Verity District. Hugging it so close, Sloane is afraid Mercurial is going to scrape bottom and scrap the craft in a plume of fire. But he assures her this makes them hard to see, and more important, hard to hit. She smells burning ozone and smoke, and hears blaster fire from somewhere behind them. Coruscant is a war zone. Has the Verity District fallen to the local resistance? Or is this just another random act of violence? In the distance, the Imperial Palace. A massive, jagged thing, like a mountain swallowed up by a bruise-colored light. Spotlight spires shining up into the sky, painting the bands of dark clouds hanging far overhead with swatches of white. Suddenly, two TIE fighters scream above them.
You can tell your people that the resistance fighters are using the old cargo tunnels, the ones that run parallel to the subgrav tunnels.
He glances at her, waiting for her reply. What, though, could her reply be? The most pointed one, the one that sticks in her mind like a nail, is that these are not her people. That is a thought that thickens and chills her blood. Because what it means is that there does not exist one empire anymore. There are several. Fragments of the mirror broken. All reflecting something similar, but broken apart. And, she worries, impossible to repair. All Sloane can say in reply is, "Thank you." Two words that sound hollow. The bounty hunter must detect how little she means it.
You seem not to care very much that I just saved your hide.
I care. I also care that you have been following me.
You summoned me, didn't you?
He flashes his white-toothed smile. She turns and with a sudden surge of rage says,
When I summon you, I expect you to come as your name suggests, swiftly. Not skulk after me like a toucher waiting for a taste of milk.
They pass over the end of the Verity District and into the Federal, where the lights are still on. None will dare to breach this region, she suspects, lest they meet the full force of the Imperial Security Bureau. But then again, at the end of time, all mountains crumble and fall. They become hills, and then dust, and then the winds of change take them away. Most mountains erode slowly. But sometimes a tectonic shift can speed up its inevitable destruction. The galaxy is undergoing just such a shift.
You have a job for me, he asks. Last one went fine. Our friend the Vice Admiral found that his addiction was just too much to bear. Nasty habit, that Vice.
I need you to find someone.
I assume that.
He looks like he's about to say more, some snide or narcissistic remark. Even he is smart enough to know not to push the perceived head of the Empire too far. He clears his throat.
Ahem. Who? And where?
Brendel Hux. He's on Arcanus at the Academy.
Arcanus? Didn't the New Republic take that?
Not yet. But soon. It's under siege.
You need him done in before then. Understood.
No, not understood. I don't need him done in. This one I need brought back alive, and with good care.
He barks a laugh.
You want me to guarantee safe passage to someone on a war-torn planet? I'm a bounty hunter, not a nanny.
Then you will be disappointed to learn that he has a son.
and you are to retrieve the child as well.
The Empire needs children.
And with that, her mind flashes to the image seen back in the archives. A young boy on the cusp of manhood, standing there in an ill-fitting suit next to Palpatine himself.
I'll need more credits.
I can double the usual fee, Sloane says.
Triple it.
Or I could turn all the resources of the Empire against you. You would run, and we could chase you. You would find no safe haven, and none would dare hire you for fear that the black miasma around you would capture and choke them, too.
Bit of an empty threat, isn't it?
Is it? Do you not fear a resurgent Empire with me at its head?
Moments pass.
Double it is, then, he says.
Good. Get me to the Imperial Palace. Then contact me when the job is done, and payment will be arranged.
Interlude. The Annihilator.
Eliodi stands on the bridge, regarding their target.
It must be quite a surprise,
Xi thinks, watching the Corellian CR-90 ahead of them buck and shudder as the tractor beam lashes it.
Poor fools. Don't know what's coming.
They think it's the Empire. And why wouldn't they? A super star destroyer cuts through space like a sword tip, its shadow falling over your ship. Well, traditionally, that meant one thing. You were getting boarded. You were now guests of the Empire. You are no longer free people. Xi knows that sensation. Eliodi belonged to the Empire once, in a way. But those days are gone.
And we are not the Empire.
Forming an Empire is quite different from the Empire, after all. Eliodi looks over at her second, an Amwati, Shishu, his spindly fingers running through the crown of feathers atop his head. Xi asks him,
Remind me again what we're looking at,
The Starfall, he says. Senatorial ambassador on board, Teodor Emshwa.
Eliodi hums.
And also remind me why we are picking a fight with the New Republic so soon.
The pirate's head is full of details and data, rife with debts and assets, thick with the names of those who betrayed Shur. Eliodi is trying to seize an opportunity here. The slow death of the Empire and the rise of the revivified Republic leaves pirates and criminals, such as Jurself, scrambling for a foothold. But Eliodi doesn't just want a foothold. Xi wants the whole mountain.
This seems unwise. And one hopes that here the juice is worth the squeeze?
It is,
Shishu says, nodding.
They are on a mission to Ithor, hoping to, seduce them into joining the New Republic. As part of the seduction, they bring with them a ship full of wonders, reclaimed Ithorian artifacts, but also food, meds, and a bounty of tech. It would give our flotilla quite the edge. Even here, we stole this ship, but we still need to keep it stocked.
Good, good. And the ship is properly subdued?
It is.
Carmaray?
Fried like a Shara bread.
No mistakes. Not like last time. The Rangs almost had us because someone forgot to seal the breaching airlock.
It is all handled.
Then, let us plunder.
The destroyer draws the corvette into its belly. Eliodi moves into place along with the others. They move to breach, and Xi stands just behind a pair of weak-weight pirates with arc lancers. As they burn a searing line around the edges of the door, Eliodi does a few vocal exercises and practices the speech in your head. Xi pops her knuckles and rolls her neck. And then, it is done. The door is opened. The way is clear. Eliodi gives the nod. The two pirates storm in, flinging flash grenades. They go off, filling the channel ahead with pulsing white light. She stands aside as more of her crew rushes in. From the entranceway come the sounds of yelling, crying. Another flash detonator going off. Eliodi hums a song in tune with the universe, hands behind her back, eyes shut tight, waiting, meditating. The pirate ruler does not know how long this lasts. Eventually, though, Vinthar gently pats her arm.
It is time,
the reptilian says.
The captives are secure. The ship is at peace. Your presence is required.
He hands Eliodi a long Baroque staff. She also takes from him a vocoder, which she secures around her throat like a choker necklace.
It is time, indeed,
she thinks. Vinthar steps onto the ship. From back here, Eliodi hears his speech, a speech she wrote.
Greetings,
he says, his voice deep and resonant, as if the reptilian creature is stepping out onto a stage to address an eager audience. The lizard announces,
I am Vinthar, the Sarkhan of Eggbrood Sharsinazar, and I welcome you to this unscheduled boarding, friends of the spaceship designated Starfall. I envy you today, for the blessing you are about to receive as you are poised ineluctably to meet His Highness, her glory, His wonder, her luminous magnificence, the Picaroon, the Plunderer, the Pirate Ruler of Wild Space, the glorious knave, Eliodi Maracavagna.
Shoot her. As Vinthar presses himself against the hallway wall with a deferential swoop, Eliodi strolls onto the ship with a long-legged stride. Chin up, eyes down.
Project confidence. You'll one day rule this galaxy.
She eases her shoulder forward, and a cape of chromatic scale falls over half her front, shimmering as a wave of colors sweep across it like a turning tide. Eliodi takes the staff she's holding and taps it twice against the ground. A swooping scythe blade snaps open.